You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is General Retired David Petraeus. General Petraeus served over 37 years in the U.S. Army, culminating his career with six consecutive commands as a general officer, including commanding the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center in Fort Leavenworth, during which time he oversaw the development of the Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual. He did five general officer commands in combat, including command of the surge in Iraq, command of U.S. Central Command, and command of all coalition forces in Afghanistan. Following retirement from the military, he served as the director of Central Intelligence Agency. He earned a PhD in International Relations and Economics from Princeton University, taught in the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. He's also held academic appointments at six universities, to include lecturer and Kissinger Senior Fellow at Yale's Jackson School of Global Affairs. Over the past 20 years, General Petraeus was named one of America's 25 best leaders by U.S. News and World Report, a runner-up for Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the Daily Telegraph Man of the Year, twice a Time 100 selectee, Princeton University Madison medalist, and one of Foreign Policy Magazine's top 100 public intellectuals in three different years. Recently, General Petraeus co-authored with historian Andrew Roberts the book Conflict, the Evolution of War from 1945 to Ukraine. Now, saying all that, it's almost like I should be David Letterman and say the man who needs no introduction, but there it is. Sir, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, John, and thanks for not mentioning that the person who beat me out for Time Person of the Year was Vladimir Putin.
Yes, sir. I did see that. The world changes for sure.
It does, and thankfully I've been sanctioned by him a few years ago as well.
I haven't made that list, sir, although I wrote a book that did pretty good in Ukraine. I didn't make the list, but that's okay. There's still time. So, sir, I know that you're short on time, and what an honor to interview you, and I really enjoyed Conflict, your recent book, and I hope we get to talk about it. But I wanted to start off with, I know from following you for years, basically, that you're a warrior scholar, and you always have been, studying war and military history and social sciences. And I think I remember reading you even would quiz your officers on foot marches when you were a battalion commander. If I recall, one of the questions that it just, for some reason, it stuck to me, you would ask about the meat grinder, which was referring to the 1916 Battle of the Somme. Do you still believe that it's important to study military history as a military leader or even a national security leader? And what periods of the past do you think most rhyme today? And of course, if there's any that's urban focused, that would be amazing, sir. But do you still think that's very important?
Oh, absolutely. It may be even more important now. In fact, one of the reasons that I did the book with Andrew Roberts was to provide the military historical context for the invasion of Ukraine. But I think very much that, again, studying history, trying to learn from it, although we should acknowledge that history can obfuscate as well as illuminate. In fact, my PhD dissertation was on the American military and the lessons of Vietnam, which, interestingly, were not necessarily what I think should have been the right lessons in a number of cases. So it shows that individuals can interpret history differently. They can take different lessons from history. But no, I think it's absolutely vital to study the history of what was our profession. Every situation is unique, though. As I did note, actually, to Secretary Rumsfeld when he asked me to do an assessment of Afghanistan on my way home from my three-star tour in Iraq, these are two very different situations, two very different contexts. And I compared and contrasted Iraq and Afghanistan and actually said at that time, when violence was still very low in Afghanistan and quite high in Iraq, that Afghanistan was going to be the longest of the long wars. You could just feel it. You could, when you analyze the circumstances, it was just vastly more difficult than Iraq, noting that the violence in Iraq, paradoxically, was at least several times that in Afghanistan, a much more violent place. But you could see how you could actually work your way out of that. Whereas with Afghanistan, especially given the problem of sanctuaries that the Taliban and the Haqqani network had in Baluchistan and North Waziristan, respectively, you could see how challenging it was going to be. So again, I think you really have to have a feel for this. I think you have to have a granular understanding, not just of the circumstances in the conflict in which you're engaged, although that's imperative. And we did not have sufficient understanding of Iraq when we invaded it. And we didn't have the sufficient understanding of Afghanistan when we invaded it either, although we did brilliant initial campaigns in each to take down the respective regimes.
Yes, sir. I think for some reason, Michael Howard's comment about the breadth, depth, and context of military history has always stuck with me. Even in your book, Conflict, I, of course, gravitated towards the challenges of urban combat in military history from 1945 to Ukraine. The Battle of Manila sticks with me because I think people have forgotten that how big of a challenge that was, or even the post-Fourth Geneva Convention's Battle of Seoul. And I took one comment out of your book, actually, where MacArthur said, by seizing Seoul, I would completely paralyze the enemy's supply system coming and going. And how important in Operation Chromite, it wasn't just the Incheon landing, which was a military amazing operation, but it was also the progressing forward and seizing the city of Seoul, which was extremely complex.
Well, there's a number of urban situations in the post-World War II period, obviously. There were certainly some in Vietnam. Iraq was full of these. And by contrast, Iraq was much more an urban battlefield than obviously was Afghanistan, which was much more of a rural battlefield. And in fact, the Afghans really controlled all the major urban areas right up until just a few months before the final Taliban offensive. So just very, very different contexts there. But Iraq, I think, very substantial urban combat. We learned a great deal about how to do it over the years. It took us three times to get Fallujah right.
Yes, sir.
And we only got it right when we told the people in advance, we're going to make your lives better by getting Al-Qaeda out of them. We seized the hospital first to ensure that it was ready and prepared to take care of civilian casualties and could not be used by the extremists. And then painstakingly cleared every building, every room, every neighborhood, and then created gated communities, as we called them, essentially walled off the neighborhoods, I think 12 or so of them for the whole city, and had biometric ID cards that were required to go through the entry control points into each of these different neighborhoods. And then, of course, very rapidly began restoring basic services, rebuilding damaged schools, clinics, bridges, roads, and so forth to revive the economy. By the way, I think there are a lot of parallels between those operations. Fallujah, Ramadi was another one, Bakuba was another, Mosul, of course, a huge one, parts of Baghdad and other urban areas. There are real lessons from that for what Israel is trying to do in Gaza. Noting that Gaza, I think, is the most fiendishly difficult urban setting of any since 1945, and that includes Hue City and a number of the other really major urban battles during the war in Vietnam. The challenges of an enemy who doesn't wear a uniform, who uses civilians as human shields, who holds a large number of hostages, has 350 miles of subterranean infrastructure, tunnels, headquarters, and so forth, all underground. High rises, not just a few story homes in some cases. And of course, a huge number of civilians in these areas. So very, very challenging.
Yes, sir.
And I think the element that needs to be added actually to what it is they're trying to do, I do believe that they do need to destroy Hamas. And as you well know, destruction in military doctrine terms means rendering the enemy incapable of accomplishing his mission without reconstitution. And keep your eye on, of course, without reconstitution, because I don't see that element present in what they're doing right now. Obviously, they have to dismantle the political wing. Hamas can never be allowed to run Gaza again. And of course, get the hostages back. But how you do that really matters because, again, I think there should be the addition to what they're doing of an announcement, a commitment to make life better for the civilians in Gaza by taking out the enemy and then keeping the enemy separate from the population. Again, you'd have to do gated communities for this, I think, as well. And I know that presents some political challenges domestically and internationally, but I think it's unavoidable. If you're going to keep the enemy from being able to reconstitute, you can't clear and leave because the enemy will come back. As we saw with Al-Shifa Hospital, they had to go back in there and clear it of hundreds of Hamas that had reconstituted. You have to clear, hold, and build. So, of course, in my view, the appropriate campaign design would be one that is a comprehensive civil military counterinsurgency campaign, noting that, yes, Hamas had in the beginning 24 battalions, X number of brigades. They were organized somewhat like an army, a terrorist army, rather than just insurgents and guerrillas and so forth. But pretty quickly, as those battalions are defeated, destroyed, and all but four of them have been destroyed at this point, you have to treat them as insurgents, as guerrillas. And therefore, the right campaign model should be to clear these areas, then hold them, and again, keep the populations separate from, secure from the enemy, noting how challenging that is with an enemy that doesn't wear a uniform. But biometrics are very, very useful here, because there are mountains of video that they're able to draw on and to identify who is a terrorist and who is an innocent civilian. And then to build right away, to get flood areas with humanitarian assistance, restore basic services, rebuild damaged and destroyed infrastructure and so forth. And that kind of commitment, I think, would go a very long way if they were able to do it. The challenge for them, of course, is that it would take tens of thousands of troops to do this. They're loath to reoccupy Gaza and shouldn't do it, certainly with civilians. It would be strictly military. But there's no alternative, I think, to that. But again, the most challenging urban setting imaginable. And of course, as you're conducting operations like this, you've always got to keep in mind the question that I had posted on the wall of those five op centers when I was privileged to command in combat. And it asked, will this operation take more bad guys off the street than it creates by its conduct? If it creates more bad guys than it takes off the street because of loss of innocent civilian life or unnecessary damage to infrastructure, homes, and so forth, then you're sowing the seeds, in this case, of Hamas 2.0. So they've got to take great care in what it is they do, especially as they go into this next campaign at the southern border crossing with Egypt, the city of Rafah, which also has about over a million displaced civilians in its vicinity right now, and another enormous area of complexity.
Yes, sir. A lot there, bringing back my own memories of doing the invasion in 2003 of Iraq, and then going back actually under your command, sir. I was a company commander, a part of the surge, working those gated communities, working with the local population.
In which unit?
Sir, I was in 3rd Brigade, 4th ID.
Ah, great. What neighborhood were you in?
Sir, I was in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we moved over to Adamiya later, but I was in a part of the Battle of Sadr City, working the basically reestablishment of security.
Yes, exactly. And of course, what you'll remember, that what I thought was really extraordinary in the Battle of Sadr City was that our combat engineers did an almost immediate transition from carrying out combat engineer tasks. When the guns fell silent, they immediately switched into repair, recovery, reconstruction mode. It was really quite extraordinary to see how quickly they could make that transition.
I think this is why I want to title this podcast really Defeating the Urban Enemy. And so much of what you said, especially like the Battle of Wei, basically an unprepared enemy defense had taken the city. You know, many aspects of the physical terrain played into it. But how do you, and I want to go back, sir, I know it's a long time ago, to your division command and the invasion, about the difference that people are kind of starting to mix in with that clear hold build, even if it's an urban-centric enemy. You first have to clear the enemy who controls the power at the moment. And I know that was a big issue. You know, you were the 101st Division commander for the Iraq invasion, and it seemed to be an urban terrain-based enemy, although there were some in like the Karbala Gap. But I actually found that really interesting in your book, sir, is you're talking through Najaf and other aspects of how do you destroy the urban enemy first, as in the military, and then move into this kind of lower intensity, clear build hold operations like Ramadi and other cities that you oversaw.
Yep. And of course, it was much tougher in subsequent years. The truth is, in the invasion, first of all, you're in a conventional war mindset. And the enemy accommodated that to a degree. The enemy was fighting to a degree as units, although you certainly had the Saddam Fedayeen that were a bit more like guerrillas. But they weren't embedded in the population the way the enemy became embedded later on. So by 2007, when we started the surge, Al-Qaeda and the tough Sunni insurgent groups were really hunkered down inside Fallujah and Ramadi. And Adamiya was another, it was a very tough Sunni area. Although when you went in there, I think we'd largely broken the back of that. But it was very different from the fight to Baghdad, when there were some organized units that you could fight definitely in a conventional manner, and the population got out of the way, as opposed to these later battles where we had to literally clear every building, every room in Ramadi, and then keep it secure. And the same in Fallujah. Those two in particular, I think, were very, very difficult, challenging, required painstaking operations. Somewhat different than some of the other ones, but each one, of course, always unique. But the idea of clear, hold, and build is the big idea here. And I fear that if Israel doesn't do more of that, that you're just going to see Hamas reconstitute again and again and again when they leave a certain area. Now, that may dwindle down a bit because the Israelis control the entire border, including the one really with Egypt now as well. They'll have an internal border so that they are counting on the Egyptian crossing being policed just by the Egyptians. I think they learned some tough lessons about that.
Yes, sir. And I think this has kind of been the crux of my conversations with people, is understanding that basically that shift from conventional to unconventional aspect to what the focus and the basically the priority of the mission is. Like in the invasion, it was a conventional mindset. I jumped into the north, a part of Operation Northern Delay with the 173rd.
Uh-huh.
We had a very conventional mission, close with and destroy the enemy for these reasons, for the purpose of facilitating the drive to Baghdad to take the regime out. How do you see Israel? So I've gotten a lot of pushback on Israel could approach this mission differently, as in not going with the conventional mindset of destroying the Hamas military and taking the regime out of power. Do you think that sometimes, I mean, I do, that people try to intermingle these two without understanding the context of, like, Israel's mission, which was, you know, a combatant force of a 40,000 military with rocket supplies, with hostages, and most importantly for me as an urban guy, defensive terrain, yeah. As in they prepared for 15 years.
They know that terrain, and again, the Israelis don't know where all the tunnels are. They don't have the understanding of the neighborhoods. Nonetheless, I think certainly if you are fighting an enemy that is organized, that is fighting as companies, perhaps organized as battalions and so forth, you fight them in a bit more conventional way. The difference is that you, again, don't want to just continue to pursue the enemy with the same forces. You need to hold the areas that you have cleared, and you should go back and clear them. As you know, if you don't hold an area,
yes, sir,
the enemy will re-infiltrate it. And that's why you've got to ensure that and get in the gated communities. You know, this is not a large area. I was in Israel about a month or so ago and talked to very senior folks, these most senior folks in the Ministry of Defense and elsewhere. And we were discussing, for example, you could wall off the entire north of Gaza and have a couple of entry control points that connect it to the center and then obviously the south, and then sub neighborhoods within that, because of course you're talking about very large urban sprawl. But that's what's required. If you're really going to keep an area clear and not just leave it and watch them re-infiltrate and then try to reconstitute as well.
Yes, sir. Actually, this is how I got into urban warfare scholarship, as I wrote an article, which for some reason, despite all your work, sir, nobody knew that gated communities and the use of concrete was a big part of.
Concrete's huge. It's all about pushing concrete. You remember, we were laying,
yes, sir,
I forget how many miles of wall in Baghdad every single night of the surge.
I wrote an article that the most effective weapon in modern war is concrete.
Exactly. No, you're exactly right. But by the way, also let's note, to be fair to the Israeli Defense Forces, they're sort of where we were in the beginning in Iraq.
Yes, sir.
We didn't have a counterinsurgency field manual when the insurgency actually began. Very few individuals had actually had the kind of experience. You know, if you were someone who only went to the National Training Center with heavy forces, with no civilians on the battlefield, with no urban areas, with no IEDs, all the rest of this, if it was just force on force. And of course, it took us even a few years there to transition that to the kind of mission rehearsal exercise that would be much closer to reality with, again, insurgents, guerrillas, extremists, suicide bombers, host nation forces, host nation officials, urban areas, et cetera, civilians. So keep in mind, again, the only urban operations they've done are essentially punitive raids occasionally into Gaza in the past, or certainly the security presence in the cities of the West Bank. But that's very different from clearing, holding, and building. But again, if you haven't trained for it, if there's no muscle memory of it in recent decades, if there's no doctrinal manual for it, you have to do discovery learning. And that's what we did all the way up until, I would contend, probably 2007 with the onset of the surge, where everyone was on the same playbook because we're actually executing the counterinsurgency field manual that we had drafted in that one command tour that I had of the six that was not in combat, the one at Fort Leavenworth, where you control the doctrine directorate. You have oversight of all of the schools and centers and all of the professional development courses for commissioned, non-commissioned warrant officers, the scenario with the National Training Center, et cetera, et cetera. So it used to be termed the engine of change for our Army, because if you used all the hats you had, I had six different hats, in other words, six different titles, then you could really change the Army. And if you had your boss's support and the chief of staff of the Army's support, and I very much had that with General Wallace at TRADOC and General Schoomaker as the chief, who would come out once a month to do the pre-command course, and therefore allowed me a lot of dialogue with him during those visits. You know, you could never publish a manual from start to finish in less than a year if you didn't have that kind of scope for initiative, cut all the corners, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, sir. I mean, one of the challenges I see, though, and I 100% agree, and really amazing review in your recent book of, you know, chasing all the way back to the Tiger of Malaya to Baghdad, basically, and all those considerations. How do you feel that the almost, so I was a part of the invasion, and, you know, of course, by April, May, we're full in humanitarian aid, civil disturbance, anarchy, many elements of trying to learn as we went. But when you have a scale of this, where you have in a very condensed operating environment, a high intensity conventional battle against an organized military force, now kind of pushed into southern Gaza, highly densely, highly populated, while you still have, like you said, you still have an ownership to hold and build in other areas, but at the same time, it's almost like they're fighting the battle of Mosul at the same time they need to fight the battle of Ramadi, at the same time they need to go into stability operations in other areas. It seems extremely complex in a condensed amount of space, but also time, because I don't think people discount the time. Even between the first battle of Fallujah and the second battle of Fallujah was 6 months of trying to use the Fallujah Brigade as a partner to bring order, and eventually that was not proven to work. And then time was allowed to set the conditions to conduct the second battle. But in this case, you have the hostage situation, you have the international pressure. How do you figure out how to fight a conventional fight while doing, you know, a counterinsurgency, counterterrorist campaign in the same amount of terrain under a time constraint?
Well, you have to have the right techniques, the right tactics, and so forth for the fight you're engaged in, but knowing that you're conducting it as part of a counterinsurgency campaign, not just as a conventional war fight. And this is what we did during the surge in Iraq in particular. I mean, we actually, people all focus on the hearts and minds issue. And, you know, Petraeus was this kinder, gentler multinational force Iraq commander. And in certain ways, that was correct, because we really did want to take care of the people. We wanted to improve their lives. But we also dropped more bombs during that time than any time before, because we were conducting major operations to clear elements of the bad guys from these different areas, often in urban settings, and then to hold it. But we knew that at the end of the day, we weren't just clearing and going on as we did during the fight to Baghdad. We were going to hold it. We actually did have to leave forces behind, I should note, in the fight to Baghdad, because there was no other post-battle element that could take over from us. And the assumption that the Iraqis essentially would stay in their positions unless they were the very senior Ba'ath Party members of Saddam's regime was flawed. Everybody fled. And so you had very little, if any, local leadership to give a hand in this stuff until you actually rebuilt it, as we did in Mosul very quickly. I mean, we had an interim provincial council within 2 weeks of my arrival in Mosul with the 101st Airborne Division. But no, in this case, they have to have what it is that they want as the desired end state. My view is that it should be, again, gated communities with sufficient forces and over time local partners that you can keep the enemy from reconstituting and separate the enemy from the people and keep it that way. But I don't see that right now. Now, there are some other challenges beyond this being the most fiendishly difficult context. Keep in mind that Israel couldn't afford to have 7% of its workforce in uniform, as they did at the outset. And they don't have the tens of thousands of troops that they can use to secure these neighborhoods in Gaza. So some real challenges here, and they're really wrestling with it. I had very good discussions with them on all these issues. They understand this, but the limits of resources and so forth, the need to allocate shortages, as always, as we say, really makes it tough for them. But they've got to work their way around this. And I believe, again, there should be a commitment to the people that is then operationalized very quickly, that we are going to make your lives better by getting Hamas out of them and keeping Hamas out of your lives, and then employing the techniques that could be used to do this.
Yes, sir. I think one thing that really key to me in the gated community and local partners, as I, even under your command, sir, as I had 10,000 sons of Iraq just in my small area of Baghdad, which were local partners, some of them with a different past. I know you struggled with that, and I struggled with my soldiers to understand, like, okay, yes, these people weren't, you know, basically for us. Now they are. Some of them have blood on their hands.
Yep.
But they're now local partners that are helping create stability in our area of operation.
Yep, exactly right. And again, this is an outgrowth of the reconciliation campaign, which we'd actually done in Mosul in the beginning. By the way, we did all of the stuff that we're talking about here in Mosul in the first year. We had units broken down into very small units, combat outposts throughout the city of Mosul and then in the other major cities of Nineveh province. Did all the techniques that we're talking about. We didn't have as much in the way of biometrics at that time. That came later. But the clear hold build was the bottle that we used. And I've been fortunate to have observed the counterinsurgency campaign in El Salvador as a young major. I was in Haiti with the United Nations Force. I was the chief of operations for the UN force there. A lot of nation building activities and also training of host nation security forces. Bosnia for a full year, where you actually had a very comprehensive, you could call it a civil military counterinsurgency campaign, although not many insurgents, but we did have war criminals, and then we also had terrorists. And I was dual hatted as the NATO chief of operations for the stabilization force, and then also the deputy commander of a clandestine joint task force that, with special mission units and intelligence agency assets, et cetera, and FBI. We were doing the war criminal hunt, and then use those same forces to conduct counterterrorism operations immediately after 9/11 as well. So that was almost the targeted, the sort of the night raid component. And it was that model, actually, the multi-year roadmap that we adapted in Mosul. The difference being that in Bosnia, you had a UN mission that could take on certain tasks. I believe they were doing the police training. You had some international organizations that were doing governance, the EU. You had others that were doing the judicial reform, and we were even using really contractors to do most of the host nation security force training. But if you looked at all those elements and said, okay, we don't have all of these other helpers here, the contractors all fled, as you may recall, when the UN compound in Baghdad was blown up and the great international diplomat Sergio de Mello was killed, they all left. And so we had to do it all ourselves. And again, that's fine. Figure out which unit might be able to best help in these different respective ministries. In some cases, it was very easy. We had two signal battalions, as I recall. And so one of those supported the Ministry of Telecommunications. We had a field hospital that could support the Mosul Hospital to rebuild it and reconstitute it. The university was a bit challenging because we didn't exactly have an education corps. We had a couple of people in the civil affairs battalions, but basically just gave it to one of our two aviation brigades and said, hey, figure out how to do it, Colonel. And he did, and they did a magnificent job. And we reopened a university of nearly 30,000 students with, I think, 20 different schools and so forth, fairly expeditiously. So again, you have to get that in mind, get that campaign design and all the rest of that. But we did reconciliation on steroids in Mosul after that disastrously bad decision to conduct the de-bathification, to fire all of the Ba'ath Party members down to the level four, which included, as you'll recall, tens of thousands of Western-educated bureaucrats who we desperately needed to help us run a country that we didn't sufficiently understand. And of course, that compounded the problem that was created by firing the Iraqi military without telling them how we're going to enable them to provide for their families and no roadmap for the future, which created hundreds of thousands of trained soldiers who still had their weapons. The incentive was to oppose the new Iraq rather than to support it. And again, the problem with de-bathification was there was no agreed reconciliation process when it was announced. Thankfully, I was able to get an exception for the 101st Airborne Division from the Coalition Provisional Authority Ambassador Bremer, so that we were able to do that quite quickly, and it was very successful. But then it faltered. It was, unfortunately, when I left, Dr. Shalabi in Baghdad refused to honor the agreements that we had made, and Mosul then saw the same kind of decline that the other areas did. But that was, again, in the back of my mind as we began the surge to try to conduct reconciliation based on the big idea that you can't kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency. You have to reconcile with as many of the rank and file as you can, as you do indeed increase the relentless pursuit of the irreconcilables, the leaders, the more nefarious members of Al-Qaeda, the insurgent groups, and the Iranian-supported Shia militia.
So, sir, this is, I think, leads me to the million-dollar question of when do you know you're in a counterinsurgency? Could we say we were in a counterinsurgency in Iraq before the Saddam regime was taken out of power?
No, I don't think so. I think that the forces we were fighting in the beginning were a mix of Republican Guard Corps, which were the most elite of their conventional units, the regular military, and then the essentially these Saddam Fedayeen, which were a bit more insurgent-like, but didn't have all the infrastructure, didn't have all the other elements that eventually made the insurgents in Iraq so challenging.
Yes, sir. No, and I agree. And you got to have a viable partner. I mean, I think, you know, just for me looking back, even at the Battle of Fallujah and the difference between the first battle, second battle, all the political considerations of the who you're fighting for, right? In that aspect, once you've gone into the counterinsurgency phase, you're fighting the counterinsurgency for the government, the either provincial council or the democratically elected government of Iraq.
Well, you're fighting for the people. And keep in mind, in Anbar province, of course, in which Fallujah, Ramadi, Heat, a bunch of other these cities were located, in which we had to conduct operations, in many cases, there was very little host nation governance. In some ways, that made it easier. I mean, but, you know, there was no functional government in Ramadi. Just to get to the green zone inside Ramadi, you had to be in a tanker or Bradley fighting vehicle because you were going to be shot at. And I remember going down there. I forget whether they hit our vehicles or not, but again, you couldn't do it in even an up-armored Humvee. So that governance extended maybe to the T-walls that protected the green zone. And so you had to really go in, but over time, you're doing it to improve the lives of the people. You're doing it to try to win hearts and minds, to gain their support, first for our forces, and then ultimately for the reconstituted Iraqi local government and local security forces.
I know you believe that Hamas has to be destroyed, has to be finished.
I do.
And that means their leadership, who could say they, especially if we broaden the breadth, depth, and context of historical analysis, I've been saying that if Hamas, as in that senior leadership with that small remaining military force. If that senior leadership survives or is not destroyed, then politically that might be viewed definitely by them as a massive victory.
It could be, yeah, depending on how many of the leaders you get. But yeah, I mean, now keep in mind, it took us 10 years to track down Osama bin Laden. And during that time, Al-Qaeda Central, by and large, was arguably defeated, if not destroyed. We did destroy Al-Qaeda in Iraq and, you know, took out leader after leader after leader, as you well know. But that's instructive because after our final combat forces departed in late 2011, and the prime minister of Iraq immediately took actions that really tore the fabric of society apart once again between Sunni and Shia. He targeted the most senior political figure from the Sunni Arabs, the vice president Tariq al-Hashmi, and his security detail, preferred charges, then went after the Sunni minister of finance and his detail, then went after a prominent parliamentarian from Anbar province. They took their eye off Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which by that time was the Islamic State, which had been destroyed. They were focusing on the Sunni demonstrations and the other issues, the unrest, and that allowed the Islamic State to reconstitute and ultimately, within a couple of years, to establish the first ever Islamist extremist caliphate in modern times in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria. And of course, we had to go back in another 5,000 or so troops to help the Iraqi security forces to destroy, to eliminate that caliphate, and actually to destroy the Islamic State. But of course, we're still there to help the Iraqi security forces, especially their counterterrorism service, keep an eye on the remnants. There are always remnants. And if you take your eye off them, they can reconstitute. And that is what will happen and has been happening actually in Gaza with Hamas. And again, keeping in mind that the Israelis have some real challenges when it comes to force density. How many of your troops can you keep in uniform relative to being in the economy? And of course, it's not just about Gaza. That's the main effort, but there's also a big challenge in the north where tens of thousands of Israelis have had to move out of the homes up there because of Lebanese Hezbollah launching rockets and drones and so forth. And of course, there's some stuff coming out of Syria around the Golan. And you even have the Houthis who are primarily focused on disrupting freedom of navigation through the Red Sea, but they also occasionally launch something toward Israel. So the challenges are very, very considerable. And then add in unrest in the West Bank, and you can see that there are numerous endeavors in which the Israelis have to engage at one time. And then on top of that, you have Iran launching an unprecedented attack from their soil, the first ever attack from Iranian soil on Israel, well over 300 drones, surface-to-surface missiles, and cruise missiles, with a spectacular defensive effort by the Israeli Defense Forces, supported also by U.S. Central Command assets, which took out about a third of what headed toward Israel, and also the U.K. and some other nations in the region.
Yes, sir. Something you said reminds me of the 2016-17 Battle of Mosul, which was a giant operation, the largest urban battle since World War II, actually. And one of the reasons was definitely all of the political considerations that allowed ISIS to rise because of that sectarian divide and gain military capability to seize terrain, which was unique. And actually in Mosul, much like Fallujah, the time when an enemy has time to prepare defense, it's going to take a lot to retake that. And ISIS was given 2 years based on capability.
Yep.
And it took that massive force. Like you said, the CTS, the counterterrorism force, actually lost thousands of soldiers being deployed in this conventional destroy your enemy and seize that terrain, that dense urban terrain. And I think that's instructive too, as in based on trying to mix in this. At times, you do have to have a conventional mindset, but you definitely have to have a plan for, just like they did in Mosul 2017, is, okay, how are we going to reestablish services and rebuild and reconcile with those even in the population that were actually supporting ISIS? But the massive conventional fight that just 2 years of preparing Mosul ended up causing the biggest battle since World War II.
Yep. Look, Mosul's a tough, densely populated, over 2 million people, second or third largest city in all of Iraq. It's also, of course, has all of the ethnic and sectarian and political and religious fault lines that run through the Middle East, seem to run through Mosul and Nainua province. So no, it was very tough. And that's why it took 9 months, as I recall.
Yes, sir. 100,000 Iraqi security forces, which was rightfully so, a mix of Sunni, Shia, a coalition of diverse security forces in order to just defeat 4,000, estimated between 3,000 to 5,000 ISIS defenders. This is what I try to argue to people, like you have to have these capabilities to actually do the conventional mission as well as learn from all the lessons, especially that you, sir, have put together, not just in the counterinsurgency manual, but now in conflicts. You have to learn from the lessons from what's the full plan. But you also have to have this conventional capability to remove that power in the urban terrain.
Yep, of course you do. And then you have to hold it because you're going to render what is initially organized as a somewhat conventional force.
Yes, sir, of course. And the enemy can drive some of that. Even Western Mosul, 80% of it destroyed. Lots of precision-guided munitions. We ran out of Hellfire missiles.
Yep.
But if the enemy defends in a certain way, and even the ISIS in Mosul didn't have a vast subterranean environment, or I think it would have went a lot differently.
Yes. Yep. No, I agree.
Well, sir, I really appreciate the time that you've given me. Fascinating. Oh, actually, the biometrics. Actually, when I was in Khan Yunis, I was there, I think, right before your recent visit. The advancements in biometrics and the ability to use that even in a conventional fight, but their ability to deploy the biometric as in facial recognition now to be able to separate that enemy force from the non-combatants was really interesting.
Exactly right. Yep. No, exactly. And look, John, pleasure to be with you. And thanks for all that you have done to contribute to modern scholarship on urban operations.
Thank you, sir. I've had great mentors like you just from a intellectual and academic development. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, John. Airborne.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out IndieWire's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.